today. Hold on to your hats. It's Champions League match day 4. In Turin, Man United party like it's 1999. Mourinho enjoying his Wednesday, meeting the old lady, getting to Marouane, and then having a lively reception. Meanwhile, in Belgrade, Pavkov the net as Red Star give Liverpool a black eye. We've round up an extraordinary week and then look forward to all the big things coming up this weekend, from Aberdeen Hibs to the Super Classico by way of Milan Juve and the Manchester Derby. It's the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Juventus, I respect, but in a beautiful Italian, they insulted me for 90 minutes.
Capitano del Manchester verso Fellini, palla sotto porta e finisce in rete con un'incredibile carambola.
When you went out and celebrated, Juventus players obviously was very upset.
Do you understand Italian?
No.
So ask the FA, they will translate for you.
Yep. Mourinho's got his mojo working again. And here we are, another exciting Totally Football Show. James Horncastle's back.
That is I.
So is Big Tom Williams.
Hello, James.
Hello to you, Tom. And we're also joined by FSF Award nominated Pundit of the Year, Pat Nevin.
What?
Yes, you are, Pat.
Excuse me?
Like you haven't voted 12 times this morning.
What is that?
Yeah, it's the Football Supporters Federation.
Oh, right. Oh.
Yeah, they have awards for all sorts of worthy categories. Tom, can you suggest another category that's...
I don't know, off the top of my head, Podcast of the Year, perhaps?
There is a Podcast of the Year. There is a Podcast of the Year category. Exciting one. Now, what a week it's been. You can vote for it if you want, listener. Go to the FSF's page. Oh, before I say anything else, actually... listeners, I think in North America, obviously we have different adverts included in the show by local kind of podcast platforms around the world. Listeners in North America have been having some Fox News and various other dog whistle-y style things coming in. Now, that is completely not supposed to happen, both because of our blocks and the blocks of our providers in North America. Apparently, third parties have been classifying these political adverts as car adverts, and that's how they've been slipping in. We're told it's not going to happen again, but our sincerest apologies to anyone who had to sit through that. Anyway, as I was saying, what a week. Probably the best week the Man United fans have had in a very long time. They win, Liverpool lose.
It's their best night in Europe ever.
Well, what else have they done in Europe? Anyway, let's start with that. One night in Turin, or Turin Breaks, as you would probably call it, Pat.
Go for that. That's a good show.
We all saw the game, I presume.
Of course.
Me less than anyone, I suspect. It seemed to me an unexpected result, but weirdly, the game was almost entirely as expected until the last 5 minutes or so.
Yeah, I think Juventus felt they should have been out of sight, you know, before they got the goal, and what a goal it was from Cristiano Ronaldo. They'd hit the post through Khedira, they'd hit the bar from Dybala, and straight after they went 1-0 up, they had a glut of chances.
Well, before that, they had a gut of chances. Lovely line, actually, from Jonathan Liu in his report. He says, first the guts, then the glory. Yeah, very nice. Anyway, sorry, that goal celebration aside, as you say.
And then I think Juventus, as we've seen in recent weeks in Italy, I wouldn't say they necessarily got totally complacent, but they looked to control the game rather than kill it, I think, in the final 10 minutes. And Mourinho made his changes. He brought on Mata. He brought on Fellaini. And boy, did they make a difference. We saw Mata score a free kick just like he did when he got them back in the game against Newcastle a few weeks ago. And Fellaini, while he didn't score, he wreaked havoc.
Big part in both goals.
Exactly.
The second goal, there's three Juve defenders exclusively marking Fellaini, which kind of leads to all that confusion and the ball being bundled in by Juve's own Alexandro. So 5 minutes left in the game. Man United were facing a real problem because Valencia won earlier that day. They were sitting in third place and their European campaign was about to take a really bad turn.
I don't think it would have been an absolute calamity if they'd lost. But I think to get a win in such unlikely circumstances, I mean, I've seen some suggestions that, as James has alluded to, quoting Martin Keown earlier, that this was one of the great European nights for United. I mean, it was a great result for United, but it was not a great performance. It was an improved performance.
Right.
I think victory flattered them. But I mean, they kept in the game. They worked hard. I mean, I think they looked a lot more... They looked more like a Champions League team than certainly in the first game against Juventus when they barely laid a glove on them.
If it wasn't a great team performance, was it a great managerial performance then? As James mentions, the substitutions bearing fruit, And then, of course, the post-match scenes. Classic Mourinho, Pat.
Brilliant. You know, first of all, in your intro, you talked about partying like it was 1999. I take it you mean by the late goals. I'm thinking more by the style.
They won in Turin. They came from behind in Turin that year as well.
The madness of, wait a minute, the style of the goals. Can I say, get it in the mixer? Is it any more complex than that? Now, I have no problem with it, but looking at the style of it and looking at the system well and comparing it with the other teams around just now many of us love watching, it was lump it in the mixer. Now,
but it's so effective. Here's a question from Keshav Rampal, who says, how is Max Allegri, arguably the best reader of the game, not able to handle Fellaini and Mourinho long balls?
Because you can't with that sort of level. You can, as long as you get the perfect ball in those sort of areas, if you look at what they've got and their capabilities, if they use it right, you've got Pogba's height there. Lukaku, when he's on, he wasn't on this one. Fellaini's incredible in those sort of situations. Throw in a couple of centre-backs as well. And a brilliantly sort of played ball in. You know, you can be the best team in the world, but it's almost impossible to defend that. And by the way, you can be the best defence in the world, which Juve generally are, and it's still going to be incredibly difficult to stop. So, yes, I'm applauding it, but is it what I want to spend my life watching in a football game? Not necessarily, no.
But it was brilliant to see, though. What a dramatic finale. Mourinho couldn't have had more vindication if he had a vineyard in a place called Cation.
No, and I just thought it will go down as one of the kind of iconic Mourinho moments that, I mean, if the gesture after the game at Old Trafford where he puts the three fingers up signifying to his treble, which he said was the darkest hour in Juventus' history because of the rivalry between those two teams, that was only lasted a few seconds, really, when he did the three fingers, whereas this was kind of up there with when he ran on the pitch at the Camp Nou and under the sprinklers pointing in the air. But
also a sign of how far he's fallen, in that the last time he paraded around gloating on the pitch after a big Champions League win, it was after a semi-final second leg when his team had produced a tactical masterclass to beat one of the best teams in history. This time it was after a decidedly spawny group stage win against a team who remained top of their Champions League group. So it wasn't a triumph, but I mean, clearly Mourinho doesn't need much invitation to.
One thing though, I mean, a lot of people scoffed a bit when he said after the defeat at Old Trafford, I think another bad result at the time, that, well, we didn't have Marrow and Fellaini. But Duncan Alexander, the numbers before and after Fellaini comes into this game. So before he made his entrance, 20 shots for Juve, 5 for Man United. After Fellaini comes on, 3 for Juve and 5 for Man United. Fellaini had 2 successful passes, won 3 aerial balls and basically turned the game.
And that's the thing. United, all they needed was a set piece. Or two in this case. And that was coming from launching it up to Fellaini, him getting flick-ons, and then them giving away free kicks around the penalty area. And that was the thing that Allegri was furious about after the game. It's like, we just need to be cuter when it comes to what we're doing around our penalty. We shouldn't have been giving needless free kicks away.
It's hard to do, though. It's really hard to do because he is fantastic. I have to say, over the years, and it's not looking back at any sort of change of attitudes for it, I have never said a word negative about Fellaini, ever. I can never think negatively of him. Yes, he can be crude. Yes, he can be cumbersome. But what he actually adds to a team, what he gives to a team, is exceptional. And there was talk last season about Fellaini maybe leaving Manchester United at the end of this season. I thought, he'd be the last person I'd be getting out of that club. Because his effectiveness is astonishing for the style of play that Jose Mourinho's got.
All right. Direct opposite of Romelu Lukaku, possibly then. Paul Scholes is my hero, right? And with Man United now looking so much more fluid without the bulky and slow Lukaku, what happens to Romelu now?
Yeah, I mean, his form has obviously tailed off of late, and they didn't miss him at all against Juventus. And I think actually for that sort of performance, when they're playing on the counter-attack, they are better suited with someone like Alexis Sanchez through the centre, who has got a little bit more pace, perhaps doesn't quite present as much of a goal threat as Lukaku does at his best, but we've not seen Lukaku at his best for a little while, so he isn't really any great loss. And yeah, as you say, I mean, Lukaku's a doubt for the derby, so you'd expect that Mourinho will pick a similar team to the one that he did at Juventus. And if United can pursue this current run of form without Lukaku, it might, you know, we might get to a point where it's difficult for him to get back into the team. I still think United lack a cutting edge when he's not in the team, because as well as Anthony Martial's been playing recently, and as good as that has been to see, you know, Alexis Sanchez's goal-scoring form has been non-existent since he joined United. Marcus Rashford sadly can't be relied upon for goals. They don't score many goals from midfield, so I don't think in the long term they can do without Lukaku. But, it is looking a bit tricky for him.
Right.
Well, for me, their best player again in Turin was David De Gea. De Gea kept them in the game with, what, three decent saves. I wouldn't say any sort of eye-catching world-class save, but there was that one where Cuadrado put the ball across the box and deflects wickedly off Matic. He made a big save. And again, it's a stunning comeback. Again, you have to salute the kind of resilience of this United team to keep doing this. But ultimately, it's not from a free-flowing great performance. It's from moments, free kicks and their goalkeeper.
Well, as they head into the derby this weekend, in which they'll be facing a team that's unbeaten, rarely concedes, very similar, of course, to Wednesday night. How much, even if the performance wasn't good, just winning a game like this in a club where there's been talk of there being splits or dissatisfaction, etc., Pat, what would that mean for the morale as they go into the visit to City?
Obviously, it's going to lift them a little bit, but a little bit only, because it's Manchester City and it's different. Early in the season, Manchester United went down to Stamford Bridge, and I'm thinking, right, okay, you go and try and play football against Chelsea the way they're playing just now, and you will lose, and you lose quite badly. You'll have to go and play to your strengths, which we have talked about already. Manchester City, just multiply that by three, maybe four. If you go and try and play football against Manchester City, they'll batter you, even if you're Manchester United just now. So in a way, yes, that'll give them a lift. I think the biggest lift, actually, Lukaku not being in the team is probably a decent thing for them. Because, you know, if they were so sluggish, there was not enough movement up front, at least they'll get a bit of movement. Personally, I'd put Martial through the centre. I think you'd be by far the better player through the centre of all the three attackers they've got left. But that'll give them a lift. But are they good enough to... Not even good enough, that's the wrong way. Are they energised enough to play at a level that you have to play at to stop Manchester City just now? That is a massive question mark. And I mean, they won 2-1 at Juventus, but as we've all said, were they that good? Not really.
I think they were better than they have been. They've come from behind to win in three of the last six games. But if you look at the first two of those results, you know, one of them was against Newcastle, one of them was against Bournemouth. You know, the first halves against Newcastle and Bournemouth were absolutely diabolical. I mean, they were dreadful. Whereas United turned up from the start against Juventus, and I thought they had a much better idea of what they were doing. I mean, they were pressing. When do you see Man United like press opposing teams and
depressing usually?
Usually deeply depressing, particularly if you're a United fan. I mean, that could be a factor. But I mean, I think what you saw was a team buying into what the manager had asked them to do. I mean, I'm not sure that it's necessarily a motivational issue, but it's clearly different going out to play a Juventus or a Man City when you've got a very clear game plan than going out to play Newcastle or Bournemouth, and as we know, Mourinho doesn't really coach his attacking players, and they're kind of left to their own devices. And I suspect that this team, you know, people often point the finger at the lack of leaders in this team. And it's been a feature of Mourinho's tenure that they've often raised their game when they're playing against quality opposition. I mean, they went and won at the Etihad last season in slightly peculiar circumstances, but they did. They beat almost all their big rivals last spring. So they have that in them. And I think that first half against Juve in particular showed that, you know, when they all know what's expected of them, they can raise their game.
Absolutely. All right. Well, it leaves them in the group 2 points behind Juventus. In second place, 2 points clear of Valencia, who, of course, they must visit on the final day of the Champions League group stage. In a second, we'll be back talking about Manchester City and what they got up to midweek and all the rest of that Champions League biz, including you, Liverpool, after this.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Manchester City Wednesday night, making it 12 goals in two matches, a 6-0 win over Shakhtar Donetsk. The Sterling penalty is going to grab the attention here a little bit. I mean, it was a weird one.
It was a weird one. I'm not sure it was so weird that he deserves being on the back page of half the newspapers today.
What the paper said about him?
Well, they've said unpleasant. I mean, I think the suggestion is that it was, you know, it was in some way dishonest what he did.
Did someone actually write, he meant that?
No, I don't think anyone's suggesting he meant it. I think the suggestion is that he perhaps might have been a bit more fair play and own up to the fact that he had just kicked the ground and tripped himself up. And in an ideal world, perhaps he would have done, and it would have been a nice thing to see. But at the same time, I don't think you can really blame him for having not done that. He's a professional footballer. It's his job to win football matches. And if the referee makes a mistake and awards a penalty, it's in his interest
to go along with it. You've listening to too many footballers. You really have.
No, I mean, I know. I don't
accept that's right. This should be a
it's not right, but I mean, like, in an ideal world, he would have owned up to it. It would have been nice to see. How many footballers in that situation would have done that, though, if we're being honest?
Pat.
Thank you. One hand up.
Current footballers.
Well, the thing is, it shouldn't be current. Forget about anything, right? Couple of things here, and I'm going to shock you here. I'm going to say something negative about the sainted David Silva.
Hmm.
Right, because he goes and grabs the ball off Sterling, doesn't he? And I'm thinking, fine, he's going to go put it in spot and kick it over to the side of the pitch or something. He's not going to score, or he's going to roll it back to the goalkeeper. And then he's not taking it. I think, well, they're still going to miss it because it's so stupid and ridiculous. But they don't do it. And Pep's giving it the old finger wagging, going, that wasn't a penalty. Good, get a message on there and tell me to kick it by the post then. Is that ridiculous? I would really have hoped that somebody within that group there would have done that.
Right, well, Pep afterwards saying, yeah, it wasn't a penalty, but then what about last year when Liverpool? Yeah. So, yeah, it's a shame, isn't it? Because they didn't need the goal, to be fair. They had five other decent ones.
I have to tell you, that's not a good argument.
Mm.
It shouldn't be that. It should be a level of morality should exist in the game. Now, I know there is no to some people morality within the game.
Yeah, I don't know if you've been reading the papers at all, Pat. Yeah.
But levels of morality within the game, you know, very, very limited, and there is in business as well. But if, in the midst of it, in particular newspapers, if you don't actually go and ask that question, or if you make an excuse saying, well, they are professionals, no, just stick it out there and say, you know what? If you're a golfer, you can do the right thing. If you're a snooker player, you can do the right thing. If you're a tennis player, you can do the right thing. Why is football different?
Why is football different? Well, getting lost amidst all the noise, Gabriel Jesus getting his first hat-trick. Now, first hat-trick ever, is that, Tom?
First City hat-trick,
first
definitely.
City
I'm not
hat-trick,
sure if it was
right.
His first hat-trick ever.
Anyway, a big win for Man City heading into the derby, and they're looking very comfortable in that group. Leon in second place after being pegged back from two goals up by Hoffenheim, the other game in this group, just to quickly mention, because Hoffenheim became the first team ever in the Champions League to come back from two goals down with only 10 men. Well done, Hoffenheim.
And that after having done the same thing in the reverse fixture.
That's true.
Two successive 92nd minute equalisers for Hoffenheim against Leon.
Stop.
Yep.
No hassle for the Hoff.
And by the way, they were brilliant against Manchester City over there. I was at that game and they were so unlucky not to get something.
It's a good group, that.
Yeah.
I mean, Leon will be absolutely kicking themselves because they just can't defend a lead. But
anyway, the derby is huge for both sides. City have Liverpool and Chelsea breathing down their necks, 2 points behind. United, 9 points behind City in seventh place, urgently need the points to try and claw their way back towards the Champions League places. Now, Pat, you mentioned the fact that last time, even though City looked out of sight by half-time, somehow Man United ended up winning this.
Every single game you ever play, there's the capability of a team winning it. When I talk about Jose Mourinho or Styles or things, don't get me wrong, I admire him. I hugely admire Jose Mourinho because he finds a way. How he managed to do it with Real Madrid, with Barca, we know. So I'm an admirer of it. It might not be the most beautiful style to watch, but he's quite capable of doing it in this game. The one biggest thing they've got in their favour, and it is one thing.
Is it Marouane Fellaini?
It's worse than that. It's Kevin De Bruyne.
Ah.
I was at the game last Thursday where he came on and played. He played for 80-odd minutes against Fulham. And I would give that about a 9.75 out of 10. It was one of the best displays I've seen
really?
In years from a professional footballer of any level. And then he got injured with 2 minutes to go and he's out for another few weeks.
Yeah.
Now, they've got plenty of not bad players available. Mm. If he'd have stuck De Bruyne in that sort of form in this game, honestly, just get the white flags out. I don't think that's the case now. There is a possibility, but I wouldn't bet against City yet. I mean, I still think they're fabulous form. And I'll stick by my initial comments early in the season when people said it would be close this season. Man City were miles ahead last season. And they're two players at least better off this season. I can't see anyone getting near them.
Only 2 points in it for now, and maybe that gap will disappear this weekend. Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, as Pat says, you wouldn't vote against City in their current form. They've won 10 of their last 11 games. back-to-back six-goal wins. Clearly, De Bruyne is a miss, but I mean, I think they're playing every bit as well as they were at this stage last season when they first started to really blow us away, and people don't make as much noise about it because we're now used to the sort of football that City play. You know, I mean, they are the favourites, but again, United have potentially turned a corner. I mean, it's particularly with Mourinho, you know, in his third season, you feel like you're never that far away from the whole house of cards collapsing, and it might only take one bad result for us to find ourselves back where we were a few weeks ago when people were talking about how long he was going to be sticking around for. I mean, you know, there are signs of improvement, and I think the way they played against Juve, as I said earlier, will give them a lot of belief. I mean, they've not lost at the Etihad for something like 4 years, United. They've actually got quite a good record there. They've won on their last two visits, I think, or at least two of the last three. And it's not beyond the realms of possibility that they avoid defeat. But yeah, if you were putting money on it, you'd obviously back City.
I think what the staggering thing is about Mourinho is that the narrative seems set. You know, the third season syndrome, him inevitably going to get the sack, it all going up in flames, that seemed, it was written, you know? And now he seems to have completely bent away from that.
Yeah, I don't think we've ever seen him come back from the decline.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that there still aren't problems there.
Can I possibly make an argument against that? I think we get lost in that little narrative because Kane fits a wee bit. I'm not actually 100% sure about it. And okay, maybe the big thing about Mourinho is, on top of all that, yes, it may be a little bit of a dip, but if you give him enough time, he would come out of it again. But he tends to move on before you give him another year.
Mm.
And maybe you say, is that the manager's fault or is that the club's for not sticking by the guy?
Well, yeah. Here's a question. Are there any United players who'd get into the City team?
De Gea?
You'd have De Gea over Edison.
In terms of his goalkeeping, mm-hmm. but given that this composite team will almost exclusively feature City players and probably play City football, you'd probably end up keeping Edison anyway because he's a better fit for that team. Yeah, I'd
so that's it, De Gea. Anybody else?
I'll put Pogba in there now.
Before De Bruyne?
Pogba?
Yeah.
Who would you
before
take out?
Well, not before De Bruyne.
Or Silva?
But, you know, maybe...
Who?
I was going to say maybe a fading Fernandinho, but at the end of the day, Fernandinho was one of the best players in this game at the Etihad when they last played, even though, what, they ended up losing that game 3-2, and he's so important to that team, but, you know.
By the way, that still
I'd be fascinated to see what Guardiola could do with Pogba.
Yeah.
You know.
Still, I think what Wednesday maybe showed is that it doesn't matter whether any United players get into the City team or not.
Fellaini would maybe, you know?
Yeah, for the last 15 minutes, perhaps.
Yeah. To be fair, that doesn't win you a game of football. Although you can have 10 better players than the other team, but if your 10 aren't working and aren't organised...
So very true. Hey, maybe that's a lesson Liverpool need to learn after what happened to them on Tuesday over in Belgrade. A shock 2-0 defeat by Red Star. Now, Pat, you were actually there in the Maracanã. Tell us, first of all, there's a lot of talk about atmosphere in football grounds. Have you been in something like this before?
You really don't want to get carried away because hyperbole is such a big thing in football. And every time you go to a game, and I can remember being so excited after a Sampa Genoa game that I went to. I've got Celtic Rangers games, sort of European nights with Celtic. Recently, Julian's not here, I can say it. Paris Saint-Germain in a European night is fabulous.
Is it?
And it is absolutely fabulous. But I'll be honest with you, this is as good as any. And you know, the Belgrade was astonishing. We were told before the game, their press guy came up to us and said, you are going to get a surprise tonight. It will be a better atmosphere than you think. I said, well, it will win the best ever. Yeah, very good. We have got another surprise for you. And then we are saying, very good, we've heard all this before. The game hadn't started, and we were like, wow!
Yeah.
It was an assault.
And they sang in English for your benefit.
You know, the whole thing, the whole spectacle. But what you tend to get, and even the biggest derbies, and we've all been at them, after 5, 10, 15 minutes, you know, it calms down a bit and you got on with the game. Didn't happen here.
How much?
65 minutes still doing it.
How much impact did that have on the result?
Yeah, it's a great question, James. To be fair, I think it had a massive impact. I don't think there is a player in that Red Star team that Liverpool would buy. Not one. But they still managed to lose 2-0 to them. So Liverpool didn't have a good day. But the spirit that was engendered within that team from that feeling, that noise, that power alongside them, they rode on it. They surfed it for 45, 50 minutes. And then they just fell apart because they had nothing left.
Right.
And it was a classic backs to the wall, throwing everything up, defending, you know, last-ditch efforts. And they managed it, but they had nothing left. But they got overexcited by the noise, those Red Star players. But because they got that two-goal lead, they managed to survive it.
Milan Pavkov with the two goals in the space of 7 minutes. Not one of the bigger names in European football. Red Star had bought him from some really tiny Serbian side. And because they feel that they only used him for 7 minutes in the course of the season. But because of that, had to pay an extra €50,000 to the club they got him from. And it was called the most expensive 7 minutes in football history by papers. But then eventually they brought him back after he did well out on loan, and he does this. And Rory Smith writing, without wanting to rub salt in Liverpudlian wounds, that is a brilliant result, not just for Red Star, but everyone outside the big five leagues. The Champions League need these teams, and it needs them to be good. It was a great result for the Champions League.
Yeah, I mean, a Red Star in the Super League? I don't know. Are they an invited guest in that? But yeah, no, it was fantastic. I think, as I think I said on the goals show, their best night since they actually won the competition by beating Marseille and Bari.
No, it was the best result in Europe ever. Tom, you speak football. What did they say about it in Serbia?
So I have the front page here, one of the Serbian papers. I can't read what it says in Cyrillic, but it does say in French at the bottom, est-ce que c'est truqué ça aussi? Meaning, oh, was that fixed as well? Because clearly after Red Star got a spanking at Parc des Princes against PSG, this story emerged that one of their directors had bet on a 5-goal defeat, and lo, it came to pass. And clearly that hasn't gone down very well in Belgrade. So a little response there in the papers.
Whoa. Saucy stuff there from Red Star. As for Liverpool, great quote from Jurgen Klopp, asked if he can put his finger on what went wrong. Ha! I only have 10 fingers. Can we help? Can we pinpoint how it all came unstuck?
I thought what he said after the game was really interesting, because he said that, OK, the atmosphere lifted Red Star, but it didn't get to Liverpool. He said what got to Liverpool was the psychology at half-time of walking down that long tunnel and seeing all the Red Star players and all the Red Star directors, coaching staff, in such a positive frame of mind, kind of celebrating. And Liverpool, on the other hand, were in a kind of really negative kind of spot at that point, from particularly how they conceded the second goal, which came out of the blue, and a mistake.
Yeah, I've just got to say, last time Liverpool were behind in Europe and saw their opponents celebrating, it sparked an entirely different reaction, of course.
That's true, yeah. Mm. But again, this is their, second defeat in a row on the road in the Champions League.
Well, it's the third defeat in a row away from home in the Champions League, actually, because...
Roma.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the Champions League final, I suppose, was away from Liverpool as well. But, yeah, in this season, that has certainly complicated matters for them after they beat the team that they expected would be the one challenging them for top spot, PSG at Anfield.
Yeah, absolutely.
They didn't have to do much against PSG at Anfield, who were hopeless on the day.
Some suggestions that Klopp, by rotating the squad, was trying to basically spin too many plates at once. Do you think that's fair, or they've got the squad to cope with that kind of thing? Do you remember the suggestion from Gary Neville that they should focus on either the league or the Champions League?
Yeah, I understand that completely. Because he added a few more, such as Shaqiri, etc., you thought, maybe there'll be Keita was added, Fabinho as well. So you think, there should be depth there. And then it only takes an injury or two, and you think, actually, no, they're not exactly bare bones again, but they're struggling a bit.
That was the other thread from this game, was that Shaqiri obviously wasn't there because of the kind of atmosphere. And what they were expecting, from when he was playing for Switzerland, was it against Serbia, and he made the Kosovo kind of
gesture thing on his boots as well during that game.
But Shaqiri has been, in what's been a kind of indifferent patch of form from Liverpool. He's been one of their kind of best players in this recent period. So to be without him, I think, was
you're absolutely spot on. At the game, you're looking at, you're thinking, you've got to make a change at halftime. They bring on Firmino. Actually, again, Klopp, I think, made quite a poor decision tactically. Start the second half, Mane was looking really good in the first half, go down the left hand side. Come on, the second half, he switched him over to right. Hardly got a kick after that. Didn't get into really particularly dangerous positions, and the left hand side was left for Firmino, who basically just faded about and didn't really do anything. Whereas Shaqiri stuck on there might have made quite a difference.
Okay, what about Sturridge?
This has been an issue for Liverpool, because we look at the rotation and the players who came into the team in Belgrade, but their first choice 11 haven't really been doing the business this season. I mean, yes, I mean, in the league at least, they're 2 points off the top, they're unbeaten, things have been going well. But how many times have Liverpool got people out of their seats this season? I mean, you know, that they're doing well in the league and they're right up there in contention, but I think we're still waiting for Liverpool to turn up. You know, they're not sort of swamping teams the same way they did last season. I think I've seen suggestions that perhaps Klopp is trying to make them a slightly less manic team, a team who can play, you know, a little bit. A team who can, you know, don't need to be 100 miles an hour to win football
less
matches.
Less heavy metal,
you know, perhaps more sort of classic rock.
Nice.
You know, they're getting the results, but they do seem to have lost something.
Well, yeah, the last 9 games, the only teams they've beaten were a depleted Red Star at home and Huddersfield and Cardiff.
Mm.
So, you know, the worrying news is that this weekend they're facing another Serbian striker, of course.
Mitro,
big clash with Fulham. Leaves the group really, ridiculously well poised. Napoli and Liverpool a level on top with PSG 1 point behind and Red Star only a point behind them and only 2 can go through to the knockout stages. Oof.
Introducing Paddy Power's Beat the Drop. We're giving every customer 30 days free entry and a grand up front. It's up to you to keep it. All you have to do is answer 10 questions correctly. Play now at beatthedrop.paddypower.com.
On Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere, this is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
Well, Fulham at the weekend, at home, which couldn't really think of an easier or a more accommodating fixture. A Fulham side that's conceded record amounts of goals in the, 11 matches so far. We'll talk more about what awaits in the league later on, but let's just round up the rest of the midweek Champions League news, or at least the headlines. Now, in that group, Napoli and PSG making it so very level with that 1-1 draw down in Naples. Tom, you got quite excited about PSG, so what were your thoughts on this?
Well, they were dreadful in the reverse fixture at Parc des Princes. They needed that fantastic goal from Angel Di Maria in stoppage time to get them a point. And the feeling was that they'd got themselves out of a bit of a hole with that. They were much more convincing against Napoli. Neymar was very impressive. Mbappe played quite well first half, at least, set up the opening goal. They went ahead on the stroke of half time, and then Napoli absolutely flew at them the first sort of 15 minutes of the second half. It was fantastic to see. San Paolo is, you know, sort of in flames around them. Buffon, who hardly had a thing to do in the first half, makes about 4 really important saves in the space of 5 minutes, and then they end up equalising through Insigne penalty. PSG had a penalty appeal of their own turned down later on when Juan Bernat was caught by Maximovic, I think it was, and then they created one last big chance. PSG cut back from the right foot, Mbappe, and he puts it wide from about 15 yards. And my feeling was that they played well, PSG, and that, you know, it's the first time in the Champions League this season that they've played someone decent and actually looked good.
Right.
But I think having had the opportunity to win the game and not taken it, they're now in a really difficult position. If they beat Liverpool in their next game, you know, that's them on their way to the last 16. But if they lose that game, which you can envisage, that might be them out at the group phase, and all the sort of the kind of soul searching that accompanies each PSG exit from the Champions League, which we've got used to seeing in sort of March, April time, is going to be taking place in November, which is certainly not part of the project plan.
Absolutely. Okay. PSG, by the way, as we look around the rest of the matchday 4 news, their next opponents, PSG, are Monaco, and they were in action as well, playing Bruges. Thierry Henry looking for his first win in his 5th game in charge of Monaco. He didn't get it, Tom.
He didn't get it. Poor old Monaco. I mean, the funny thing is, they did play that badly to begin with. I mean, the first sort of half an hour or so, they were on the front foot. They made a handful of chances. Henry had picked a fairly attacking team. But as soon as Club Brugge went at them, they just fell apart. And Brugge were 3-0 up inside 24 minutes. And that was it. The game was gone. I mean, Monaco never threatened to get back into it.
Well, also because he took off Falcao,
and decides that with the game basically gone, he's going to hand professional debuts to a 17-year-old and an 18-year-old. So he threw the towel in well before the end of the game, and then with about 8 minutes left, I think, or about 5 minutes left, Brugge go through and score their 4th goal. They've now 15 games without a win, Monaco. They are out of the Champions League. They're without 12 players through injury and suspension. They're playing PSG on Sunday. Their owner's been arrested for corruption. And they've got all these fresh financial fair play allegations. And, I mean, it's still very early in Henry's time at Monaco. He's only five games in.
It might be towards the end. You never know.
You know,
here's a tweet from Football Fights. Gary Neville. No one could ever leave Sky Sports, get sacked as a manager and return to Sky Sports quicker than me. Thierry Henry, hold my beer.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think what works in his favour, and there aren't many things working in his favour at the moment, is that so many of these problems were inherited. I mean, Monaco were catastrophic under Jean de Jardim. They had a terrible transfer window. They've got this implausible glut of injuries. And Henry has done as well. He's tried to do his best with the resources he had. He's played with a back three. He's played with a Christmas tree. He's sort of moved players around, but he's really down to the bare bones. And even if everyone was fit, as has happened on a couple of occasions, there's been so much turnover in the Monaco squad over the last few months that, you know, they don't even look like a decent team when they get all their supposed first team players out.
Might just be the only Christmas tree he sees at Monaco. Also in that group, Atletico Madrid and Dortmund met, and Atleti beat Dortmund 2-0. First goals they've conceded, the Germans, in the Champions League this year, but they both look well set in the group. Five clear of Brugge, as you say, Tom. Porto also all but through after beating Lokomotiv 4-1. Lokomotiv now out of the competition. They become the second club ever to be top seeds in a group stage but go out after only four games. Can you name the other one, James Horncastle? Who was the other club that was top seeds in the Champions League draw for the group stage but who went out after only four games, as Lokomotiv have done this week? Leave that with you, come back to it.
In the history of
the Champions League, only one team has been seeded in the group stage draw.
Monaco.
No.
I'm guessing Chelsea.
No. Bayern and Ajax both looking good. Ajax had a draw away at Benfica. Bayern, of course, are going to be playing Dortmund this weekend. That's huge. Bayern 4 points behind Borussia Dortmund going into that match at Dortmund. Der Klassiker, I think that's Saturday evening. Elsewhere, Roma and Real Madrid both won. They're both now 5 points clear of CSKA Moscow, so looking good for the last 16. Roma beating CSKA in Moscow this week. Real Madrid's win was in the Czech Republic. It was their new manager, Santi Solari's third win in three. They've not conceded any goals in those three matches. They scored five here, but there was also a really nasty and very probably intentional smash on a Pilsen player's nose. I wonder if you could hazard a guess who was it? Who was the Real Madrid player who took out, basically broke the nose of his opponent right at the start of the game, kind of with no build up to it?
Was it Sergio Ramos by any chance?
Why always him?
You know, I watched it, and you will always have an opinion on it. And I honestly would love to say I think he meant it, and I can't tell you.
Do you not think so?
I don't know.
That's the point.
I don't know. Because you can always say when a player is doing something, even if he tries to make it look as if he isn't. But it was so brilliantly done and subtly done that I can't tell you for definite. I have a suspicion he meant it, but I absolutely couldn't say that for sure that he meant that one.
Right. I mean, for me, it was a lot more evident than, say, the smash on Karius that happened in the Champions League final. But he's running basically across the Pilsen player, and as he goes by, he just flicks his elbow up into his nose, and there's just blood everywhere. Yeah. Anyway, there you go.
Victoria Pilsen needed Eric Dier, clearly.
Didn't they? Bitter Pilsen.
Yeah.
In Group B, Inter and Barcelona drew. Barcelona are now through. It was a 1-1 at San Siro, which was great for Inter, with Icardi, as usual, coming up with the late goal. Pretty good news as well for Spurs, who are very much back in the mix themselves Tuesday night, coming from behind to defeat PSV. It was a terrible start. What turned it around?
Well, I think Spurs, if you take the goal they conceded out of it, they dominated this game. They should have won it, I think, by a greater margin. But ultimately, what turned it around for them was the changes that Mauricio Pochettino made. He threw on Fernando Llorente, and I'd say a bit like Fellaini, having that option to go to the big man up top next to Harry Kane. All of a sudden, Kane, who'd been pretty peripheral up until that point, had the opportunity to find some space, bit of time, got them back into the game.
I was in Belgrade, so I vaguely remember the goals. Back post header by Harry Kane was the second one.
That was the second goal.
What was the first goal?
The first was just a ball up to Llorente. Llorente brings it down, and you see Kane just inside the area, bend it into the corner.
Right. There is a reason for asking this, as there always is. Mm-hmm. Watch the Manchester City going to Spurs at Wembley, and watch even Manchester City trying to play their type of football on a bubbly pitch. They couldn't do it. It was really interesting from someone from a different era who used to play in that sort of pitch. It was very similar to an old-fashioned pitch, which we had for the vast majority of the season.
Right.
And they actually couldn't play their football on that pitch. Now, I'm watching Spurs now, who would like to play like that, you know, more on the deck. Their goals now, or a lot of the goals now, have been played long because they can't actually play that style of football on that pitch. It's really intriguing to see it now because... classic people, the game's so much better now. Yeah, you can pass the ball now because it's a flat pitch. It's extraordinary difference in it. I don't think it was as bad the other night, I believe, as it was before.
Mark Van Bommel said it was shit.
Okay, well, there you go. And it's just extraordinary.
We asked about the impact that the victory away at Juve will have on Man United. What about on Pochettino's morale and Spurs in general? Because there'd been this general kind of glumness despite... Their excellent start, numbers-wise, in the Premier League. And also, did he actually say, there was this amazing quote that I saw from him regarding rumours of interest from Real Madrid. It is like you're with your wife and you're holding hands walking down the street, but because you are so handsome, another woman is looking at you. But your wife is so proud, and rather than worrying, she is so happy to be with you and fall more in love with you.
I've not seen that.
I'd
like to believe it.
Yeah, producer Ben threw that one. And he insists...
I feel like a cow watching a train. Yeah.
I bet he was halfway through the description thinking, wish I wouldn't have went down this line just then.
Yeah. Anyway, so in the Champions League group, they are 3 points still behind Inter in third place, but Inter still have to go to Wembley and try and play on that pitch. So, yeah, all to play for. All right, next up... for Spurs is a trip to Crystal Palace. That's Saturday tea time. And that ushers in a whole world of discussion about the Premier League fixtures this weekend, which is coming up after this.
Listeners, you remember Roy the Rovers, right? Well, the iconic comic has been rebooted and Roy Race is now a 16-year-old starting out life at League Two's Melchester Rovers, a team incidentally sponsored by us here at the Totally Football Show. The first two stories are out now. Scouted is an illustrated fiction novel which follows Roy as he attempts to catch the eye of the Melchester scout Johnny Dexter and get a shot at becoming a pro. And Kickoff is a hardback graphic novel featuring an amazing 50-page story packed with football, drama, football, action, and more football after that too. It's the perfect Christmas present for football-mad kids and any parents who remember the good old days. Pick up your copy wherever you buy books, including Amazon, Waterstones and Sainsbury's. And find out more at royoftheroversofficial.com.
Crystal Palace, Spurs. Spurs are fourth in the Premier League, a point ahead of Arsenal. Got a great record against Palace. How much will this PSV game have taken out of them, or how much will it have put back into them?
I mean, obviously, it'll have taken something out of them physically, but I think, as we said, for United coming from behind to win against Juventus, that winning in those sort of circumstances, in some ways, can be more of a psychological boost than a really impressive end-to-end performance where you win by three or four goals. I mean, Spurs have won their last three in all competitions. They had to survive a bit of a scare at Wolves last weekend when Juan Foyt got involved and started giving penalties away. Spurs look like they're coming into a bit of form again. I thought Palace played really well against Chelsea last weekend. Quite unfortunate. I mean, perhaps not unfortunate to end up on the losing side, but the problem they've got is that they find it really hard to score goals, and Hodgson is now pairing Townsend and Zaha in attack as he did at the end of last season, and as good as those two players are, I think it means that the goals that they hope to score have to be of such complexity. I mean, they scored a lovely goal at Chelsea, through ball from MacArthur to Townsend, and he sort of takes a touch and puts it bottom left. But the nature of those two players, they're not players who are going to feast on knockdowns, who are going to pick up loose balls. I mean, they're both quite similar in terms of their style. I think they've got 8 league goals all season, Palace, and they tend not to lose heavily at all, but without any sort of goal threat, it's hard for them to pick up points.
Mm. Oh, well.
I've actually been stalking Crystal Palace.
You have?
Time. Yeah.
I feel like they keep threatening to do a big result. Well, do you think it could be this weekend?
Less so. No, I'm not with you now.
All right.
Purely because, I mean, I was at the game they played Everton up there. And it looked okay for a period of time, but it was classically Zaha or no one.
Oh,
it really
okay.
felt like that. And then I'm down watching a game against Arsenal at Palace, and once again Zaha had these great moments. They brought Sørloth on, and actually he looks as if he might have something, having not showed as if he's going to have anything before that. Then on to the Chelsea game, and at the Chelsea game, to be fair, I get the point. Yeah, they looked okay in the battle, but they had 23-24% of the possession, maybe not a lot more than that. Chelsea decided to bring on Hazard, but more specifically Kovacic at that point, and just blew them away within 10 minutes and then took Jorginho off. So I'm afraid they're going down. If Zaha gets injured, they're going down.
All right, well, there are only 2 points as it is off the bottom three, and that might... That might even be a margin that's disappeared by the end of the weekend. Pat, let's talk about Chelsea-Everton. It's the Pat Nevin derby. It's kind of the Ross Barkley derby as well, isn't it? Yeah.
Really looking forward to it because Everton, you know, have been flattened to deceive for such a long time, but they've now actually got the correct balance to their team. And it took, how long did it take them to figure out, which was so obvious at the beginning of last season, you build it around Sigurdsson. That's it. You just build it around him. You make sure he's the 10. You make sure that you play whatever system it is that's built around him. But last season, they were putting Klaassen in there. They were putting Rooney in there. And you're thinking, why are you putting Gylfi Sigurdsson out on the left?
Mm.
Finally figured that out. Got him there. Getting a bit, obviously, out of Richarlison. Now there's a much, much better looking balance to the team. It's not absolutely perfect yet. But that's a decent team now. So that's going to be a team that will cause Chelsea some problems, but they need to be brave enough to have a go at Chelsea. And that's the problem. There's too many teams out with the top four or five that aren't brave enough to go away from home and have a right good go. But I think Everton will.
Marco Silva, though, he's going to have a go, isn't he?
Yeah,
Everton, by the way, have won 4 of their last 5. Yerry Mina finally taking the field at the end of the most recent win against Brighton. And likely to start here because Jagielka's out and Zuma can't play because he's on loan from Chelsea. Chelsea also away in Belarus, taking on Bate Thursday night. So travel and that. Potential upset then, James, do you think?
What, Bate Borisov beating Chelsea?
Well, no, I mean, well, yeah, that. But also, you know, Everton then arriving after a Europa League fixture.
I think it'll be a competitive game. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Marcus Silva is one of the managers that I sort of admire most in this
really?
League. I think. You know,
what do you most admire about him?
Well, I just think he, you know, we've seen over, I mean, it's really good. It's going to be fascinating to see how he does over an entire season because we've only seen him 2.5 months at Watford and 4 months where he almost kept a Hull City side that was dead and buried alive in the Premier League. But, you know, he clearly knows what he wants, Richarlison being that, and is the one guy who can see, he's the Richarlison whisperer. And, you know, he ultimately, I think, can be a major difference maker for Everton going forward this season. So, but I still fancy Chelsea. I mean, how can you not?
Okay, Arsenal are just outside the top four, a point behind Spurs, and they are hosting Wolves. Arsenal unbeaten in 13 matches as we record this. It might be 14 if they do Sporting, who they face at home Thursday evening. Wolves coming off 3 straight defeats, although unfortunate perhaps not to take anything from that game against Spurs last weekend. Arsenal haven't been ahead at half-time in any Premier League this season. For all that unbeaten record, they've not been in the lead once after 45 minutes. Does that mean something?
Possibly. I guess you weigh that against the fact I think they've scored more goals after half-time than any other team in the Premier League, which explains why they are, you know, doing as well as they are. I'm not sure it's necessarily anything to worry about. It strikes me as more of a statistical quirk than any reflection of how they're playing. And I think it also shows how well Unai Emery is using his substitutes. You know, we've seen that in recent games, that if things aren't quite happening, he'll turn to his bench, and very often the guys he brings on are able to make the breakthrough. So yeah, I'm not sure that's anything to be too concerned about.
By the way, I never revealed the answer to that fascinating question about which was the only other team.
Can we have a clue?
It was Blackburn Rovers.
basically, don't waste my time.
Right.
Graham Lasso and David Batty fighting on
the
pitch.
There you go.
Yeah.
Harry Gregory's got a question for you. He's off to Genoa for the derby. Any recommendations of food, drink and things to see in the... well, the first thing to do is listen to our Golazzo podcast this week because we talk Genoa.
Yes.
Some essential background to that extraordinary club.
Yeah, I would go to the Genoa Museum. It's actually a very good one, and it's by the marina. Wonderful port, Genoa. Interesting time to be going as well, because I think this will be quite an emotional derby, given what happened with the Morandi Bridge disaster, which happened at the beginning of the season. But yeah, this is a very English and South American kind of derby in Italy, because the Ferraris, you know, you've got the... stands right next to the pitch, so it's always a spectacle. I think I'll be going to this one myself.
Oh, nice. Well,
I'm absolutely, absolutely jealous of it, but could you tell me, both of you, actually, it's been a lot of years since I've been to that derby, and I was absolutely knocked out. I turned up an hour early for it, so if someone was saying to me what the advice would be, it would be get there early.
Oh, nice, yeah,
and
good
watch chat. Out, watch what happens with the flags, with the choreographed singing, etc. I take it that still happens now.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Good.
Well, don't miss that, whoever it is, if you're going.
Big story for fans of nominative determinism, Tom. This from the Bristol Post, who revealed that Bradley Stoke Town FC in the Bristol and District League Senior Division have a new player this season. Do you know what his name is?
No.
Bradley Stokes. Yeah, Bradley Stoke Town FC... I've just signed Bradley Stokes. When he told the club secretary his name, they thought it was a joke. Bradley said he thought I was taking the piss. He asked to see my ID before filling in the signing on forms. There was more laughter when Bradley was introduced to his new teammates. This from the Bristol Post. In the changing room, most of them just started laughing at me, to be honest. They couldn't believe it. I suppose it is a bit weird. Since then, he's settled in nicely. He says he has no regrets on joining the club of his name. All the players have become his friends. Brilliant stuff. Oh, hang on, it's not a coincidence. He signed up purely because of the name. He said, I Googled when I saw that there was a town called Bradley Stokes and they had a team, so I signed up. I guess I'm in the right place at the right time. Brilliant stuff.
Heartwarming story.
It happens a lot. Happens more than you think.
Really? Well, you had Arsene Wenger at Arsenal, of course. Yeah. Wolfgang Wolf at Wolfsburg.
That's not the only type of nominative determinism. Oh. Your name means something to the thing.
Like... Emery at the Emirates.
Yeah. Raheem Sterling signing that contract.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, great shout. Yeah. Everybody thinks. No, got nothing. Right, around the world then. There's massive games all around the world. Copa Libertadores, first leg is on Saturday at the Bombonera. Boca's at home. And then 2 weeks later, they'll be playing at River Plate at the Monumental. No away fans, I believe, although they do keep changing this, but that should be an extraordinary watch somewhere on Saturday. I think you have
to
go.
It's now on Free Sports.
Oh, is it?
I think they've bought the rights. Yeah.
Okay, because that would be amazing. Mm. But there's so much football clamouring for your attention this weekend. Mention the derby Sunday in the Premier League. Mention De Clásica. That's Saturday night in the Bundesliga. You've got Milan Juve, which I imagine is Sunday night in Serie A.
It is Sunday night, James. Yes, indeed.
Right. Are you high hopes for that one?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's got potential for to be a bit of a grudge match with Higuain should be fit playing against the side that basically told him to get gone because we're signing Cristiano Ronaldo. Leonardo Bonucci, who moved to AC Milan, 18 months ago, saying that he was going to shift the balance back towards the city of Milan and then went back to Juventus with his tail between his legs. So I think there's a lot of potential there.
Milan fighting for a top four place. Juve 6 points clear, looking to maintain that advantage over Inter and Lazio. But that should be a huge game and a sizzler. It's up against that big game that we mentioned in France, Monaco PSG.
Le Plastique.
Le Plastique. Hey. Is that what they call it?
They are now.
Right. That'll do. That gives us a lovely chance, actually, among all the revelations about the behaviour of your Man Cities and your PSGs. Some glorious details revealed by Der Spiegel about Mbappe's sort of list of demands for signing on at Paris Saint-Germain. Tom?
Yeah, it was certain salary demands. He wanted to be automatically turned into the club's best paid player if he ever won the Ballon d'Or. And he wanted a private jet that he would be able to use for something. It was either 50 flights or 50 hours per year. These are his demands.
Standard stuff.
So, I mean, fairly standard stuff, I think. And he did not...
30,000 euros a month to pay three personal assistants and his rent. Or I think their rent, maybe. I'm not sure.
Mm.
Yeah.
But he didn't get all of it, though.
Well, he got that last one.
These were his demand, his list of demands, but...
Yeah.
I don't think he got the Ballon d'Or...
No, he didn't get that one.
...salary trigger or the private jet, but... Don't ask, don't guess.
James, do you have a clause in your contract if you win the FSF podcast award that you get a raise?
I don't think it'll matter unless listeners get busy. FSF, their website. Yeah. Right, okay. Well, anyway, so that's Monaco PSG. There should be goals in that, I'm thinking.
You'd have thought so. PSG going for a record-extending 13th consecutive win at
What's
the start
goal
of the season. Their goal difference, not entirely sure, probably about 150-odd, I think.
At least,
they're slowing down a bit, though. They won their first 10 games scoring at least three goals. They only got two in the last two outings against Marseille and Lille.
Right.
But now it's Monaco, so it could be double figures.
Right, okay. Just as big, in Scotland you've got Aberdeen taking on Hibs on Friday night, and then Livingston against Celtic. That's later in the weekend. If you're going along, keep your coins to yourself, listener, of course.
Ooh.
Totally Scottish Football Show has all your Totally Scottish Football needs. And it's on right now. It's up there. It's out there. Ooh, we've also got the Totally Football Show American Edition. And my word, we're getting to the sharp end of MLS. Second leg of the playoff semi-finals coming up. Seattle Sounders at home to Portland Timbers. That's this Friday, Pat. Seattle Sounders are 2-1 down on aggregate. Sporting Kansas City taking on Real Salt Lake. Atlanta United are 1-0 up against New York City. And Columbus Crew take a 1-0 lead to New York Red Bulls. Kobe Jones and company will bring you the TFS American Edition. I think that's out now as well, previewing those games. Super. Back to the Premier League, prosaically enough, where the bottom seven, Pat, are all within 3 points. You're concerned for Crystal Palace. Who else worries you down there?
All of them.
All of them.
I think we can say that.
Fulham are now last.
The one team, I wouldn't be concerned about West Ham United.
Okay.
And have not been at any point in this season.
Well, they're not in there. Flat. They're not part of the bottom
they're
seven.
They're one place above Palace, aren't they?
Yeah, three points.
But everyone else there, there's a very good case for them being in trouble for a long time in this continuing. There's nobody in that group there. Maybe you could say Burnley, if they get back to playing the way Sean Dyche knows they can play, can go and kind of get out of it. But they don't go in long runs of 4-0 wins, Burnley.
Right, they conceded 13 goals in three, which is just, you know, the biggest slap in the face of expectations I think that any club has managed to perform.
Can I go wild and say I think Fulham will get out of it?
Do you think so?
Yeah,
Fulham.
That's the one thing I think will get out of it.
Player
for player, I think they've got more quality going forward and more ability to score goals. I think they might get out of it, oddly.
With a new manager?
I'm not sure. They've had a lot of new players. A lot of new players. Some of them have taken, most of them have taken quite a long time to get to the pace of it. The defence has never been sorted out. If he kind of gets that a little bit stiffer, that defence, there's enough quality going forward from midfield. I wouldn't be shocked if that was the team that managed to get out of it.
I just look at it and think they lost to the team that can't score goals on Monday night, Huddersfield.
And they did score their goal for them.
Yes. But then you look at their run of fixtures coming up. It's really going to test the board's patience with Šćekanović because they've got Liverpool. They've got to go away to Chelsea. They've got to go away to Man United. These are all in the next six games. I mean...
I think Pat's right about the quality Fulham had. I mean, they spent £100 million in the transfer window, which I think was more than any other promoted club. And there are really good players there. But Jokanović still doesn't know what his best defence is. I mean, he was trying out another new partnership against Huddersfield. And you just think, if we're this deep into the season, we're mid-November, basically, and the manager still hasn't figured out what his best team is... Is he ever going to? And I think that given the money they spent and the quality that's there, you do wonder whether he's going to be given that much longer. Because if things don't improve in the next... can't expect them to get anything at Anfield this weekend. Then we're into the international break. And then, as James was saying, tricky fixtures to come. I mean, I don't see any signs from Jokanović that he's the man to turn it around.
A very quick argument saying that if they had Rafa down there, it would do okay because he would get them organised. And then I remembered who was playing up front for Fulham and thought, well, maybe not, actually.
Mitrovic, of course, Right, OK, 29 goals they've conceded in 11 matches so far on a trip to Anfield this weekend. Newcastle are just outside the bottom three, but only on goal difference ahead of Huddersfield. They host Bournemouth in another game that was billed as winnable by Jack Lang last week on the pod. Cherries have actually come home with 3 points on their last two visits to St James's. Both Shelvey and Lascelles going off injured in Newcastle's win over Watford last weekend. So is Newcastle are they going down?
Lascelles is a big worry. You do not want him injured because he's such a pivotal part of that defence. Shelvey, we know he's up and down a little bit. When he plays at their best, he can be a really nice looking side. I haven't said that. I like Bournemouth as a team. They never seem to lack energy in any game, and sometimes that's enough to do Newcastle.
They've got that little jinking Scottish winger as well. You can never have too many of those in a game, I think.
Yeah, one who quite likes playing out in the wing as opposed to some of us. So, absolutely. That energy's there, and you can see that from Wade. You can see that up front. And also, they've got options up front that can score them goals. You know. So
what do you think about Newcastle? Are you worried about them?
All the teams in that bottom, you know.
But you think Fulham are going to get out? Who's going to not get out?
I struggle to find a way of seeing how Cardiff can get out of it.
Right.
Again, because of lack of sort of overall quality, and can't see where they're going to get a lot of points during the season. Southampton, I think there's a capability of getting out there. Mark Hughes seems to be capable of doing it. I would say Huddersfield is a concern. Huddersfield, purely from what they did last season, they weren't spending a huge amount of time attacking teams. They were very, very negative minded, but they managed to survive in that first season excitement. Well, not now. It's different now. It's going to be hard for them.
Okay. Cardiff have Brighton. That's the early kickoff this weekend. Brighton, not generally very good away from home. They did get that win at Newcastle, but that was their first in 18 on the road. So, yeah, not good away from home.
I'd say that Cardiff, woeful defending set pieces, even though they're a worn-up team. 6 goals conceded from those situations this season. I think that's one of Brighton's sort of principal strength, so I think this could be an away win for the Seagulls.
And Brighton have been going really well prior to that defeat at Everton. I think was it 3-1-0 wins on the spin. Chris Hughton admitted that they weren't on the same level as Everton, and I think he was quite happy to sort of write that off as a step too high. But yeah, you suspect they'd be looking at that trip to Cardiff as a chance to improve those slightly concerning away statistics.
Yeah. Saints hosting Watford, Burnley visiting Leicester, and Huddersfield taking on West Ham. Well, by the way, a big sorry to Mirko Arnautovic, who we suggested was being unnecessarily evil, laughing in the face of, I think it was Tarkovsky, after the goal last weekend, that he scored. Apparently there'd been some fairly agricultural challenges flying in prior to this, and he was just, you know, he was just giving it a bit of Mourinho.
And who doesn't enjoy seeing a striker celebrate a goal like that? Not that we condone it.
I mean, he was one of Mourinho's pupils, of course. Treble-winning Marko Arnautovic.
Played a big part in that treble, yeah.
I still loved... Was it Arnautovic versus Mark Hughes was one of my favourites last year? And there was a big argument between them. And, of course, Arnautovic scores an important goal. And I'm thinking, that could end up in a fight. And I'll pay the entrance fee. I'm OK with that.
Hammers won this game 4-1 at the John Smiths last season. Interesting, of course, no Mark Noble, but who actually scored in that fixture. And Lanzini got 2 that day, is also out with that long-term knee problem. But I think still we think West Ham are going to be OK in that fixture.
And they've unearthed another skillful attack-minded player as well. So you look at the players that they've got going forward, and I feel quite sorry for them. They never seem to get even close to all their best players fit at the same time. Sometimes it's an out of it, you know, and different ones seem to break out. If they get a run of, say, 10 games with all those attack-minded players all fit, they could be brilliant this season.
Okay.
And Felipe Anderson in the goals now after that brace against Burnley. So, I mean, I've been quite impressed by him, but I think the one thing he hasn't really contributed is his goals, so that might be a turning point, perhaps.
Indeed so. All right, well, one or two more reflections on life, both on and off the pitch to come, but right now let's get the odds on the Manchester Derby and some of the other big games this weekend from Paddy Power with producer Ben.
Merci very much to you, Jimbo. Here's Lee Price from Paddy Power on the line. Lee, let's talk about the Champions League before we get onto the big Premier League fixtures. Can Spurs make it out of their group and into the knockout stages after that heroic performance against PSV?
Well, they're 800-1 to win the group, so that's clearly not happening. But their price to qualify is a lot healthier, in fairness, at 7-2. healthier that is until you compare it to Inter Milan's price, who are 1-7 to progress, leaving Spurs staring at the Europa League, which is just what their small squad needs. I'm sure Poch will agree.
Okay, we'll start with the final game of the weekend. It is far and away the biggest. It's the Manchester Derby. Can you give us the odds here, the overall odds, that is, and the first goal scorer markets?
I'm looking forward to this one. Both teams coming into this one in winning form. I don't think I'll be saying that. But the odds do remain lopsided massively towards the home side. They are 3-10 to win this one. United are 7-1 and the draw is 4-1. As for the first goal scorer market, I think that's quite illustrative. The first seven favourites are all City players. Aguero, Jesus, Sterling, Sane, Mahrez and the Silvers. Martial and Sanchez, two players in very different runs of form, are United's best hopes, we think. They're 11-1 to score first.
And you've got a money-back special running on this one too, haven't you?
There is indeed. It's a money-back as a free bet if Aguero scores, which is odds-on to do, by the way. That applies to losing first, last, anytime goal scorers, correct score, what odds, paddy markets, max refund £10, T&Cs apply.
All right, Liverpool coming off a very bad result in Belgrade. Can Fulham, who got a very bad result in Huddersfield, can Fulham get at least a point here at Anfield?
I think you might be the only one fancying Fulham this weekend, Ben. Despite Liverpool's shaky form, they're massive underdogs here. It's 25-1 they get the win, or 10-1 they snatch a draw. If you do fancy their chances of avoiding defeat, you can get a double chance bet where you bet on Fulham to either win or draw, and that's 13-2. Liverpool are 1-12 to win the game, though.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com. All prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's 18 plus only. BeGambleAware.org. And when the fun stops, stop. The controversy rages, Tom, about planes, trains and automobiles, which people were... Somebody mentioned John Candy. It would have been his birthday had he still been with us. And the question was, what was John Candy's greatest film? We saw Michael Owen. We failed to put this question to him.
I'm seeing him tonight, though.
Okay, well, make sure you ask that. Because, James, people mention Planes, Trains and Automobiles, which I kind of snorted at and said it's not a good film. And outrage, really, truly, the level of responses I'm getting, it's just, I mean, it's been unpleasant, frankly. Ian O'Sullivan points out that Planes, Trains is set during Thanksgiving. So it's not a Christmas movie, as people were suggesting last week, but it is a good gateway movie into the festive season. Maybe wait for another 3 weeks so you can get the full effect of the candy experience. I could wait longer than that if you like, Ian, but I am clearly going to have to go back and watch this film again because I haven't seen it since the 80s. Pat, have you seen it recently, Planes, Trains, Automobiles?
No, but you and I sit side to side on this.
Oh, you're not a fan?
No.
But then, it should be so good with Steve Martin and John Candy. And yeah.
See, I get this with, what's that football film, the one that everyone talks about?
Escape to Victory?
Yeah.
That's a terrible movie.
Awful movie. And everyone tells me it's the best football movie. I'm like, what?
It's a half-decent film for the first hour or so when it thinks it's basically The Great Escape. And then they kind of bring in the football, but except they don't. I mean, you get one rainbow flick in the entire movie. It's desperate.
I'm delighted you've went on the Commodian rant and stopped me going on.
It's such a bad film. Also because it could have been better. And the weird thing is when you watch it, you think, I suppose this isn't bad for like 1972. When was it? In 1980, it's such a retro. John Huston. Huston, we have a problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Here I go. But James Gulk says, is the lack of stripes regarding best John Candy film an oversight or purposeful dismissal? I like stripes, but that's a long time ago.
I haven't seen stripes. I can't comment.
Mm. Oh, well, you know what? We've got an international break coming up at the end of next week.
Mm.
So maybe what we could do is have a little look at Planes, Trains and Automobiles. And not that there's not going to be anything else to talk about, but I think we might be able to squeeze in.
And launch the Totally John Candy show.
Yeah, Totally Candy. A bit of a reappraisal of the oeuvre. Anyway, excellent. You got any big plans for the weekend, Pat?
The Everton game. Yep. I'm going to see a couple of movies, one tonight, one tomorrow.
What do you see?
And I've not decided yet what I'm going to go.
Because last time you went to see Cold War for the second time, didn't you?
Which I absolutely loved.
Cold War.
Which is fantastic.
Right, okay.
But no, funnily enough, I forgot to see. Am I actually... go a wee bit mainstream here.
You're going to go see Bohemian Rhapsody, aren't you?
No. no, the kind of, what's it called? First Man?
Oh, yeah, no, that's good. Tom, you've seen it.
I saw it last weekend. Yeah. Really, really enjoyed it. I found it a little bit mawkish in parts.
It could have been directed by Clint Eastwood.
Without the mawkishness, but the sort of the action sequences. Yeah. It really kind of brings it home how primitive the technology was in the 60s.
In that basement.
in that basement.
Excellent. Okay. And what was the other film?
No, I've decided yet.
Oh, okay, right. James, what are you up to this weekend? You're off to Italy?
Yes, I am indeed. I'm going to see my wife in the Eternal City. And then off to Milan Juve on Sunday night.
Hey, boom. Milan Juve. Boom.
I can't
Follow
compete
that,
with that. I'm staying in London. I'm not going anywhere. Can I say a hello?
Yes.
I don't know if you remember when I was last on the pod, I was talking about this duvet that I was trying to get rid of
because
I bought a duvet that was too big for my bed and I was going to take it to a charity shop. One of our listeners, David Young, replied to the tweet,
right,
putting out the pod to say that he would take it off my hands, and he came around to my flat and he picked it up. So, David, hello. Thanks for
it's a hell of a story, Tom.
Taking my duvet off me, and I hope it's fulfilling all your duvet needs.
Yeah.
So how long ago was Swap Shop?
Well, too long by the sound of it. By the way, my piano, which also came up in that conversation, I completely forgot to get back to the people who were interested. Oh. Not sure if the moment's passed, but if you are piano hungry, do get in touch.
I've got a full
table
that I want rid of.
Okay, what have you got, Pat?
Pool table.
Okay, pool table from Pat, listeners.
I'm rid of it.
Do you just want it out?
Out, yeah.
Out. Me with the piano. I just want it out. Are you whereabouts is the pool table located?
It's in the middle of nowhere in Scotland. Sadly.
It's in the middle of nowhere in Scotland. So if you are in, James?
No, I've got everything I need.
It's not what you need. You're trying to get people
get rid
things.
Of.
Yeah, no.
Get zen.
At the moment, I don't.
No, okay.
You know,
I've also got some DVD shelves.
Super. Anyway, now after that, hello to Mr. Duvet. It's time for us to say goodbye. We will be back though. Phew. On Monday, when our lineup is excitingly enough, Daniel Story, Julien Laurent, and Kelly Cates. Wow, that's my second favourite Totally Football Show lineup. Remember, you can vote for Pat and us in the FSF Awards. Your vote can make a difference. Otherwise, they wouldn't be trying to stop you having it, listener. Well, see you then.
Have influence that vote.
Sounds. No.
Yeah.
Anyway, have a great weekend, you listener, and Tom, and James, and Pat. Thanks for being with us. We'll catch you Monday.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. And make sure you check out our other football podcasts, the revamped Totally Football League Show with Caroline Barker and the brand new Totally Scottish Football Show. Supporting your team can be a beautiful thing, but then come the injuries, the goal droughts and the downright disastrous defeats. That's a little bit like life, really. And here at the Totally Football Show, we believe we should all support each other the way we support our team, through the good days and the bad. And that's why we're continuing to work with CALM, the Campaign Against Living Miserably, a charity dedicated to preventing male suicide. On average, 12 men take their own life every day in the UK. So that's your starting 11 and your manager every single day. And part of the problem is that many of us still feel uncomfortable talking about mental health and suicide, and this can often stop men from opening up and getting support when they need it the most. So if you're worried that someone close to you is having a tough time, check in with them and let them know that CALM is there. Every day from 5 p.m. till midnight, CALM provide a free, confidential and anonymous helpline and web chat for any man who needs support. Visit thecalmzone.net to find out more about CALM.